In celebration of Black History Month, we visit the New Letters on the Air archives to pull from three different programs featuring Gwendolyn Brooks, the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize, and a poet who left a legacy of work illuminating the Black experience in America.
I've written so many poems that I believe some of the poems will stay alive, and people write me wonderful letters saying that this poem or that poem has meant very much to them. In some cases, has changed the direction. So I hope I'll still be useful when I'm no longer here.
Listen to some of the poetry that makes the late Gwendolyn Brooks immortal in this edition of New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Born in June of 1917 in Topeka, Kansas, in her grandmother's home, Gwendolyn Brooks was soon taken by her parents to the south side of Chicago, where she remained for the next 83 years until her death in December of 2000. Her first poems were published in a Chicago newspaper when she was an adolescent, taken from her composition books filled with careful rhymes and lofty meditations. As a writer, Gwendolyn was always interested in poetic form, but she went to the street for her material, depicting the Chicago she knew and loved. Richard Wright admired her first book, A Street in Bronzeville, and praised her ability to capture the pathos of petty destinies, the whimper of the wounded, the tiny incidents that plague the lives of the desperately poor, and the problems of common prejudice. Her second book, Annie Allen, won her the Pulitzer Prize in 1950, and despite the fact that this secured her career, she elected to stay outside what she termed the hollow land of fame to remain on the south side of Chicago, eventually succeeding Carl Sandburg as the poet laureate of Illinois. She was appointed consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress in 1985, the year the title was changed to poet laureate. Despite her numerous honors, books, and publications, she insisted that all her life was not writing, and that her greatest interest was being involved with young people, spending much of her time introducing them to the power of poetry, as in this public reading, recorded in 1984 at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Here's Gwendolyn Brooks talking about her famous poem, We Real Cool.
I wrote this poem because I passed by a pool hall in my community in Chicago. I saw inside this pool room a bunch, as I say in the poem, of seven youngsters shooting pool during school time. And instead of saying to myself, why aren't they in school? I said to myself, I wonder how they feel about themselves. It seemed to me that they would want to thumb their noses at the establishment. And I used the month of June as my establishment symbol, because that's non-controversial. Everybody loves June. So if they thought about these matters in any conceptual way, they would want to jazz June. I understand that this poem was banned because of the word jazz, which was understood to be a sexual reference. That was not my intention, though I have no objection if it helps anybody. But I was thinking of music. The pool players, seven at the Golden Shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz gin, we die soon.
We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks, recorded in 1984. 4 years later, she returned to UMKC and talked to Rebecca Presson for New Letters on the Air.
That poem is almost a precursor of the rap, too, isn't it?
Oh, I wonder what the rapsters would say about that, but thank you.
You
I don't think so.
Raps,
I really believe it's that's something entirely different.
That it's a real traditional poem. Maybe it's just the way you recite it.
Oh, okay.
You know, the way you hit the line endings that way, so that it almost sounds like it could be a rap.
Your listeners might be interested in knowing why I put a we at the end of each line till you get down to the last line. first, when I first wrote the poem, oh, so many years ago, I said, we real cool, we left school, we learned late. But then it occurred to me that these are youngsters, that's why I wrote the poem, really. These are youngsters who don't have much attention. And they would like to have some attention. They'd like to be looked at with respect and affection by their society. So I decided to put the we at the end so you would have to pause just a split second and give them just a split second's worth of attention.
Hmm, what a wonderful idea. That's wonderful. Now, We Real Cool comes from your third book, The Bean Eaters, but you won
the Bean Eaters, yeah.
You won the Pulitzer Prize for your second book.
Annie Allen. The Bean Eaters is a much better book.
That was my question.
And so is In the Mecca. And perhaps A Street in Bronzeville, the very first. But that's not the way it happened. Judges are interesting. I have been a judge. I was a judge for the Pulitzer once and a judge for the National Book Award twice. And I can tell you some exciting things go on in those judging rooms. And the upshot of it all is that judges are human beings and they do things for a variety of reasons.
Are they honest reasons?
I believe that they all want to be honest.
Which poem gets the most votes, do you think, from people who write and talk to you after?
Well, I have to say that We Real Cool is probably the most popular poem that I've written. But another poem, which I'll read
tonight
is The Life of Lincoln West. And that's about a little boy who has a hard time because he is not judged beautiful by his society. This is because he looks African. I read it almost all the time and cringe when people say, read that poem about that little ugly boy. Because the whole idea is he is not ugly.
That's the problem.
And he's African looking, which is wonderful.
That's the problem with a poem, isn't it? Once you let go of it, you have no control over how people interpret
isn't
it.
Isn't that true?
Get it wrong or not.
And of course, that's one of the richnesses of poetry, that each one of us gives something to a poem. Hopefully, you'll get something that the poet put there for you. But because you are you, unique, different from everybody else, and have had different experiences, you're going to give something to that poem, make it richer for your own use.
In your first book, and in fact, I hope you'll read this poem, In a Street in Bronzeville, you write about abortion in a way that's so bright and truthful that it's frightening to read even in 1988. I wonder how a voice like yours managed to be heard in 1945 on a subject like that. What did people say when they read A Mother?
People are still saying sometimes that they'd prefer I'd not include that poem in a program.
Would you like to include it in our program? Because that's such a stunningly modern poem. I just can hardly believe that it was written in 1945.
Interesting. Well, first I'll tell you that I wrote it because I had a friend who had had several abortions. And she told me how she felt about her experience. And that is what I put into this poem. I understand that not every woman feels the same about that kind of encounter. The mother, abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You will never neglect or beat them or silence or buy with a sweet. You will never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them controlling your luscious sigh. Return for a snack of them with gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted, I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumult, your marriages, aches, and your death. If I poison the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness I was not deliberate. Though why should I whine that the crime is other than mine, since anyhow you are dead, or rather, or instead, you were never made, but that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you had body, you died. It is just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you all. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all.
The Mother, from Gwendolyn Brooks' first book, A Street in Bronzeville, published in 1945. This is New Letters on the Air, and you're listening to a 1988 conversation between the late Gwendolyn Brooks and Rebecca Presson as they discuss The Mother and other poems.
It's very sad. Do you know most of you?
It has a kind of joy in life, though, here. Mm-hmm. And I feel that it shouldn't be called an abortion poem, as it so often is called. I have a little catalog here of the qualities of motherhood, which I hope is not customarily missed. For instance, Or scuttle, you will never wind up the sucking thumb.
And the feeding.
Or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them, controlling your luscious sighs. That is, glad to get away from them for a while. But return for a snack of them with gobbling mother eye, which is an aspect of motherhood that I think is familiar to most mothers.
Going and looking in the cradle at night, is that what that is?
No.
No?
getting out of the house away from those children you love so much, and going downtown and looking in the shop windows or shopping, going for lunch with a friend, whatever you like to do, doing it. But at a certain time in that experience, you want to get back to those kids. You can hardly wait to get back and see their dear little faces. Well, this poem is called The Mother, so I'd like all the aspects of motherhood to be considered.
Okay. That's good enough. Now, you've really stayed in Chicago all your life, but you were nonetheless affiliated with some of the major members of the Harlem Renaissance.
Only one.
Langston Hughes. That's pretty important. What I was wondering is how the different movements in poetry have affected you, your life and your poetry. I know it's an awfully big question, but maybe you could sort of glance over how you were affected first by the Harlem Renaissance and then by the Black Liberation Movement of the late 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was certainly affected by Langston Hughes. But my introduction to the Harlem Renaissance, and I didn't even think about it in such terms until I was grown and kept hearing other people talk about it, because that is a subject that teachers love to deal with, love to talk about, the Harlem Renaissance. But I wrote to James Weldon Johnson, author of God's Trombones, you know, which includes that beautiful poem, Creation. Almost everybody who loves literature does know that. And the Negro National Anthem. And I wish that name could be changed. I'll bet if he were alive, he would change it. But
to what?
But then I haven't changed the name of a poem that one of your friends likes, a Negro hero, to Black hero. Well, let's see. James Weldon Johnson wrote back to me and criticized the poems that I had sent him. Well, his way of criticizing was to write in the margins what he thought of this or that. how this could be improved. This was cliché. She didn't use that word ever that I remember, but that's what he meant. And he didn't like my reversing certain words, which is an old poet's trick, an old poet's trick, such as Wordsworth, Keats, Shelley. So he said, I ought to read more modern poets, not to imitate them, but just to know what was being done today. That led me to read people like T.S. Eliot and E.E. Cummings, other people like that. And I went to the library and discovered a little book called Caroling Dusk, which contained poems by Harlem Renaissancers. And I became acquainted with County Cullen and Claude McKay and Sterling Brown, the two Cotters, Joseph Cotter Sr. and Jr., Fenton Johnson, who wrote that fascinating poem, Tired. I shall go down to the last chance saloon. So that was my invitation. Langston Hughes, I met because he was coming to recite at the church my family went to. I say my family, my father never went to church in all the time I knew him, but he had grown up in the church and I think was glad to have a little rest of it. But he was the kindest soul I have ever met. Had wonderful parents. Well, my mother insisted that I show my poems to Langston Hughes. He stood there and read some of them and said, you're very talented. Keep writing. Someday you'll have a book published. So he was very proud. I knew him after I got married and gave a party for him once, 75 people in a two-room kitchenette. At 623 East 63rd Street, Chicago.
So then, did he keep criticizing your work, or?
No, that was all.
No?
That was
just a word of encouragement,
just an appreciation.
Huh? Okay, well, all right. So you were writing pretty much formal structured poems all along until the late 60s, right?
Oh, no, I did write many poems in free verse. And many in iambic pentameter. The Sundays of Satin Leg Smith is essentially iambic pentameter.
In your early work, you depend pretty heavily on rhyme and on meter and the formal elements of poetry, but you did write some free verse.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I read that in the late 1960s, you had an epiphany upon hearing Amiri Baraka speak. Is that true? What happened there?
It wasn't Amiri Baraka speaking. Although he did come to that conference that you're referring to, it was at Fisk University in 67. And I had gone out there to give a reading, and Margaret Cunningham was giving a reading. Well, she later became Margaret Danner. And I noticed something different about this conference. There were young poets running around, showing their poems to each other and to me, too. One of which was Ron Milner, who became a very famous playwright. These people seemed to have a different idea about what they should be doing poetry-wise. They had a motto, an essential motto. Black poetry is poetry written by blacks, about blacks, to blacks. It's very important to say, too, that's been translated often into for, which just throws everything out of kilter. Because although at that time they were interested chiefly in a black audience, still in all, I feel, and many of them felt and feel now, and have felt long since, that poetry is for anybody who wants to pick it up and subscribe to it. But what they really wanted to do was to address themselves to blacks because they had so much to say to blacks. For instance, I'll give you an example of the kind of thing that if I had written it at that time, I would have felt would be a good illustration. It is, anyway. I have a poem called To Those of My Sisters Who Kept Their Naturals. And underneath that interesting title, I have the little legend, never to look a hot comb in the teeth. Well, now, there's no point in my addressing that poem to whites because they are very happy with what they've got on top of their heads. But not all of my sisters are. So would you like me to read that poem?
Oh, yes, very much, yes.
Sisters, I love you because you love you. Because you are erect. Because you are also bent. In season, stern, kind, crisp, soft, in season. And you withhold, and you extend, and you step out, and you go back, and you extend again. Your eyes, loud, soft, with crying and with smiles, are older than a million years, and they are young. You reach in season, you subside in season, and all below the rich, rough, right time of your hair. You have not bought Blondine. You have not hailed the hot comb recently. You never worshipped Marilyn Monroe. You say, Farrah's hair is hers. You have not wanted to be white, nor have you testified to adoration of that state with the advertisement of imitation. Never successful, because the hot comb is laughing too. But oh, the rough, dark, other music, the real, the right, the natural respect of self and seal. Sisters, your hair is celebration in the world. Then I always beg my sisters not to throw tomatoes at me, because I love them. No matter what they're doing to their heads, I love them all.
Do you think that
I get some mean looks, though, sometimes when I read that?
The late Gwendolyn Brooks and her poem, To Those of My Sisters Who Kept Their Naturals. In spite of her early literary success with major publishers, Gwendolyn Brooks came to the pivotal realization that she needed to support the black presses. So that's where all of her later books were published to help her community. Again, here's Rebecca Presson talking with the poet in 1988.
Do you think maybe that's what your poetry's about, though, is teaching self-love, self-acceptance? Is that
well,
too simple?
I certainly wouldn't make that kind of announcement. My poetry is here to teach self-reliance and self-acceptance. I have poems about flowers. And I started writing when I was 7, printing when I was 11. Because then I sent 4 poems to a Chicago paper, and they published them. They didn't know I was 11. So they published all 4 of them. That really set me up. But a poem like The Life of Lincoln West, of course, I frankly call an identity poem. Though I didn't sit down and say I am now going to write an identity poem, I wrote about a situation that is very, very familiar to blacks, to all blacks. The poem begins, "Ugliest little boy that everyone ever saw." That is what everyone said. So all blacks know exactly what I'm talking about. And at the end, when this little boy is able to say, after hearing somebody else say it who had no intention of praising him, "I am the real thing." I hope people will pick up on that and understand just what I mean. And as I say, blacks certainly will. Little Caucasian ladies, however, have said to me, "Oh, I just love that poem because I had a sister. She was prettier than I. And I know just how Lincoln West felt."
And are they right?
Well, I mean, it's what I say, that poetry, you know, you take what you need from it.
Mm-hmm. You're credited with, and this surprised me, I didn't realize that you were the first one to say this, but you're credited with saying that poetry is life distilled.
Oh, yes. I've been saying that ad nauseam. I feel a little guilty saying it because it just sounds so cliche-ish.
It does at this point, but I guess it didn't the first time you said it, huh? You seem to be a person who makes her life a whole. The way you live and the way you write, it all seems to work together. Are you saying that your life reflects your poetry as well as your poetry reflecting your life? You still live on Chicago's South Side, even though I'm sure you don't need to.
I can't say that my life.
And you seem very much to try to reach out to your community and to people within your community. You're obviously live your commitments.
Yes, but you make it sound like such a conscious thing. I mean, I grew up with a wonderful family, fine parents who believed in kindness. My mother, for instance, subscribed definitely to decency and dignity. She wanted to do right. And those were the days when if somebody knocked on the door and said, I'm hungry, if you were my parents, you would invite him in. All ragged, perhaps, sit him down at the at the table and serve him a nice hot meal. I wouldn't do that for anything in Chicago these days.
Too dangerous.
Of course, everything is all different now. But it's just natural. I feel that I should write as I do. I mean, I write what I believe. And I don't have to sit down and shape it all out because it's like something in me going in, this sounds crazy, going through the pen to the paper. And it seems perfectly natural that I would be concerned about a poor little boy whom I have named Lincoln West. And I hope everybody gets everything I put into that name out of it.
So you have a muse, is what you're saying.
No, I have never liked that idea.
No? So what does push the pen then?
Interest.
In life?
Well,
in people?
If we want to be that wide, certainly you can say that. Because I certainly do love life. Love it more and more as I come to the end of my particular slice of it.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Gwendolyn Brooks, she died on December 3, 2000, at the age of 83 in her beloved Chicago, leaving behind a legacy of poetry that makes her one of America's most respected literary figures. The recipient of more than 50 honorary degrees, she was awarded some of the highest honors in our country, including the National Medal of Arts, as well as Lifetime Achievement Awards from the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Book Foundation. In 2017, on the 100th anniversary of her birth, she was celebrated throughout the country with festivals, readings, films, and documentaries, one of which included our recording of We Real Cool. Today's show was pulled from three of our archived programs recorded in 1984 and 1988, which can be found by searching Gwendolyn Brooks on our website, newletters.org. While you're there, browse our audio archives for other writers featured in our 40-plus years of broadcasting, and sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen. For updates, follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter. Produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Production help for the program over the years has come from many people, but a special thanks to Rebecca Presson, who did the interviews with Ms. Brooks in the 1980s, and to Annie Walsh, Dennis Conroe, and Jamie Walsh for help with this compilation, and to you for listening. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.